Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I begin today with our bodies, ourselves. This by Elizabeth Gumport, who is an editor at N+1 and wrote this for the New York Times. Our bodies, ourselves, our anger. The second edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves, published in 1976 by Simon & Schuster, featured on page 229 something I had never seen before, and I don't believe I have seen anywhere else since, a photograph of a woman having an abortion. The caption, like the inclusion of the photograph itself, is matter-of-fact, informative, and free from sentiment. Vacuum session abortion at Preterm Institute in Washington, D.C. Note that the woman getting the abortion is wearing her street clothing, quote unquote. I first came across this photo several years ago while doing research on radical feminist groups. Even in that context, it was arresting because it was presented without fanfare. There was no sense that showing a woman having an abortion was, for a text on women's health, anything other than par for the course. When I learned recently that Our Bodies, Ourselves, now in its 9th edition, would no longer be updated after September, I thought immediately of this image and of the fact that it was not, after all, par for the course for any book. Our Bodies, Ourselves was originally a booklet titled Women and Their Bodies, A Course, self-published in 1970 by the Boston Women's Health Collective. The collective had grown out of a sexual health workshop at a women's liberation conference, and the booklet the members published was forthright and frankly political. The first essay, which begins with a quotation from the Frankfurt School philosopher Herbert Marcuse, is titled Women, Medicine, and Capitalism. That final word is one that is rarely invoked even by many progressive health organizations nowadays. But for the authors of the early editions of Our Bodies, Ourselves, it was crucial. Political economy and the recognition that physical health is inseparable from it helped unlock these women's understanding of their social and political circumstances, their relationships to medical professionals, and ultimately their own bodies. The insistence on a connection between politics and health remained a priority in the 1976 edition. The chapter on women and healthcare included a discussion of the capitalist theory of disease causation, quote unquote, which detailed how the medical profession treated symptoms but failed to consider the social context of illness. It was an open challenge to established institutions and accredited actors. The authors questioned the benefits of a fee-for-service model of healthcare and discussed the power imbalances inherent in the doctor-patient relationship. One area of focus in the original edition was patient as victim. By the second edition, women were no longer characterized as victims of doctors, at least not so loudly, but they weren't their equals either. In the early editions, women were medical subjects, objects of study, learning to challenge institutional knowledge and their treatment by those institutions was as important as learning about their own bodies. Knowledge had been denied to the book's authors. These denials were themselves denied, and so the women who wrote Our Bodies, Ourselves were angry. Their anger radiated from the page. It was explicit, not implicit, and it guided the book from its opening sections. Today, we think of Our Bodies, Ourselves as primarily a book in which women can find candid discussions about masturbation or birth control, and it was indeed always that. But in those early editions, politics was given pride of place. The sections on anatomy and physiology appeared only later. In the second edition, the first chapter was titled Our Changing Sense of Self. Its subsections included changing our internalized sexist values, rediscovering activity, and rediscovering anger. I recently flipped through the most recent edition, published in 2011. As Comprehensive as it was, I found myself missing the stridency of early versions. Marcuse is gone. In his place is the concrete medical information whose dissemination is, to judge by news coverage of its demise, the primary reason our bodies ourselves is so celebrated. Although much that was missing from earlier editions had found a way in information on trans health, colorism, something of the soul of those early editions had been lost. In this most recent and ultimately final edition, the politics of women's health was not elided, but it had been consolidated into its own section toward the back of the book. Our Bodies Ourselves is celebrated for making information about their own bodies accessible to millions of women. Such praise is deserved, its reputation earned, yet that ought not to be the limit of its legacy. Its boldness and its value came not just from the information it contained, but the connections it made between our bodies and the world we inhabit. Much of today's wellness rhetoric omits the argument our bodies ourselves placed front and center, that physical and economic health are not easily separated, that knowledge of our bodies demands knowledge of the social and political climate in which we live. There cannot be one without the other, and it is this lesson we must go on learning, if not from our bodies ourselves, then at least, I hope, from one another and from the model provided to us by the book and its creators. As they wrote in the introduction to that first self-published packet, the papers in and of themselves are not very important. They should be viewed as a tool which stimulates discussion and action, which allows for new ideas and for change. The material, they wrote, has been and should be used in ways other than a course. A course is only one way of spreading the word. A course is only one way. A book is another. May there still be more and many. And that was Our Bodies, Ourselves, Our Anger by Elizabeth Gumport. And as I said, she wrote this for the New York Times. And now, an earlier article about Our Bodies, Ourselves, called The New Our Bodies, Ourselves, by Lee Dolan, who wrote it for the North Coast Times Eagle in September 1985. Dr. Lee Dolan, I should say. When the turbulence of the 1960s replaced the complacency of the 1950s, Our Bodies Ourselves was the feminist bomb that rocked the medical establishment. Attacking the male-dominated profession as unfeeling and uncomprehending, the authors, the Boston Women's Health Collective, urged informed rebellion. Feeling the time was right for a second edition, the collective recently published an almost entirely rewritten version of their book, By and For Women, quote unquote. Although times have changed, the authors declare in their preface that the more we learn, the less we believe that the medical system as it is structured today can or will alter to meet our needs. And once again, the book is required reading for anyone, man or woman, who wants to know what is wrong with American medicine and what can be done to change it. As in the earlier edition, the book is a wonderfully readable mix of scientific information, anecdotes, and opinion. Women's experience is obviously thought of as least as valuable as the opinion of experts, quote unquote. There is little pretense of objectivity regarding the principles of good or bad health care. The equal right to good health care for men and women is one goal. Another is the assumption of responsibility by women to fight for their rights and for any changes in the system that are needed. Freedom of choice regarding all health decisions is felt to be worth fighting for, and victory is only thought possible by women working together. The real strength of Our Bodies, Ourselves philosophy remains its holistic approach to health and disease. Neither can be understood without dealing with the individual's relation to others and to society as a whole. The basic rule is the Spartan maxim carried one step further: sound bodies and sound minds in a sound society. Health issues are always placed in a socio-political context, the dynamics analyzed and sensible recommendations for change made. The book opens with an excellent example of the author's approach. From a discussion of healthism, an overemphasis on keeping healthy and a corresponding neglect of societal issues, we move to an analysis of the reasons for women's almost universal negative feeling about their bodies. The narrow image of beauty fed to us by the media is not only unachievable, but also leads to increasing feelings of inadequacy and inferiority. The permanently disabled are made to feel like pariahs. Being fat is an excuse to be laughed at and criticized for eating what you want, dressing as you wish, and taking up as much space as you need. The further one deviates from the mythical ideal, the less capable of healthy relationships one is thought to be. The solution is clear. If we can begin to eliminate the hatred and ridicule levied against women who don't fit the norm, we can lessen the stress of not fitting in, and with it, a lot of stress-related illness. We also open the possibility of building a social change movement of many different kinds of women, working together to change the attitude and conditions which restrict us. We feel proud and more able to control our lives. The section on relationships and sexuality emphasizes the importance of moving beyond sex role stereotypes toward a mutually supportive role for men and women. While accepting men's lesser skills in improving relationships and being friends, the authors urge that the struggle for intimacy be fought. They provide advice, but conclude that every situation needs to be individualized. The chapter on lesbian relationships is a thorough discussion of the social and legal, as well as health problems that women loving women, that's a quote, face, and is a plea for tolerance and freedom of choice. The section on sexuality is likewise a non-judgmental exposition of the options open to women. A table on sex and physical disabilities includes comments on different impairments, effects on our sexuality, that's a quote, and again a quote, helpful hints and special implications. Pregnancy and childbirth are a major focus, and as in the rest of the book, factual information is mixed with advice on how to overcome societal handicaps to the best care. The inadequate funding of proper nutrition and frequent insensitivity of the medical profession are justly condemned. Barriers to good parenting are reviewed and more fatherly responsibility is urged. The discussion of the real reasons for postpartum depression, isolation, and a loss of control is especially good. Under the heading, Inventing a New Kind of Motherhood, the authors make a number of worthwhile suggestions to increase the support mothers, fathers, and children have both during and after the pregnancy. The chapter on women growing older has been greatly expanded from a discussion of menopause in the first edition. Issues of discrimination against the aged, sexuality, alternative living arrangements, and common physical problems of elderly women are all reviewed. Appropriate survival skills, including the formation of support groups, are emphasized. Violence Against Women is the title of an angry and practical chapter on how to deal with this problem. The author's conclusion that the responsibility for the solution rests with men seems inescapable. Quote, men must stop committing violence against women, stop each other from doing it, stop condoning it in others, and stop blaming women for it. Disappointingly, a discussion of pornography had to be omitted when no consensus position could be reached. Presumably, the debate hung up on the censorship versus freedom of speech issue. In all these sections and in chapters on sexually transmitted diseases, infertility, breast cancer, quote, new reproductive technologies, unquote, and common and uncommon women's health problems, the factual information is well-researched and well-presented. It is the extra dimension of placing these issues in a societal context and recommending appropriate solutions, however, that is the book's strength. It is thus fitting that Our Bodies, Ourselves concludes with a discussion of the politics of women and medical care, both in this country and internationally, and how to bring about necessary changes. In the first edition, the authors declared that the image and myth of the doctor as humanitarian, which has been so assiduously sold to the American public for the last 50 years, is out of date. If there ever were such doctors, they are mostly all gone now. And that's a quote. They also lamented that men had yet to come together and share their sense of themselves as we have done. The new Our Bodies, Ourselves recognizes that progress is being made and even that some members of the medical profession are beginning to get the message, although not many. All healthcare professionals and all women should read this book and take heed, and perhaps all men should too. And Our Bodies, Ourselves, a book by and for men, is undoubtedly long overdue. And that was The New Our Bodies, Ourselves, written by Dr. Lee Dolan, who used to be an Astoria physician and who also was a rock jock for KMUN and now is somewhere in Portland practicing medicine. And he wrote this for the North Coast Times-Eagle in September 1985 about that second edition so much mentioned in the first article, Our Bodies, Ourselves, Our Anger, by Elizabeth Gunport. And now, I would like to read something that I wrote only a couple of months ago, but which seems to be even more applicable again, I suppose. And I wrote it, so I guess I should take whatever might happen as a result. Although January 8th already seems a very long time ago, the latest school shooting in Florida on Valentine's Day, which was also Oregon's 159th birthday, might prod a few of us to remember the anguished letter written that day by a 7-year-old girl who wrote Donald Trump with advice about how to protect school children. Her name is Ava Rose Olson with an E, and she is the age of 7, already a survivor of a school shooting that killed a boy she had planned to marry after their first kiss. That shooting happened in September 2016 in Townville, South Carolina. A teenage boy who had shot his father at home drove up to Ava's schoolyard and fired a pistol until it jammed. 3 people were hit, a teacher and 2 kids, 1 fatally. "My best friend Jacob Hall was shot and died," Ava wrote to Trump last summer in an earlier letter. "I saw it all happened, and I was very scared. So scared she is unable to go back to school. She has been diagnosed with PTSD and is being homeschooled. She continues to mourn Jacob, who was 6 when he was killed, and she has nightmares about the shooter. She remembers him saying, 'I hate my life.'" Ava wrote, "Please keep kids safe from guns," in her first letter to Trump, and asked how he would protect children from school shootings. His response, which she received the day after Christmas, was disappointing. He didn't say how he would keep kids safe, she said. So she wrote Trump a second letter on January 8th. "Sometimes people who live through a school shooting have better ideas," Ava wrote. She had 6 suggestions. Her first idea, keep violence away from school and kids. Move the schools to a safer area and help the kids be able to get there. Her second idea is make sure to have enough people around so that nobody can hurt us. Her third idea, start building schools in a circle shape with the playground in the middle. That way nobody could drive up and shoot at us. Her fourth idea is make schools or any where kids are a lot, have safe places they can run to. Ava's fifth and sixth suggestions are meant primarily to deal with aftershock and PTSD. Somehow help people understand what happens to kids like me who have seen and heard what happens when a gun hurts someone, she wrote for her fifth idea. And number six, for people to have smart people to talk to when they feel sad or scared. Sometimes people don't know how to act when they feel that way. She wrote, maybe if they had people to talk to, they would feel better and not want to hurt anybody. She ended her letter saying that her ideas would cost money, but that she could help people in charge of money not to waste it. I want to use my voice to help, she wrote and signed her name, Ava Rose Olson, with an E. Her common sense compassion seems to have had no effect on Trump. Instead, he blusteringly focused on his own inner hero as if the wanton slaughter of children was only for him a personal high noon moment. He told Americans that he was certain he, Captain America, would have attacked the shooter. And having said he would have been a hero, he comported himself as though he were an actual hero, which is all that really mattered to his egocentric misanthropy. And that was something that I wrote back in, I believe it was March, about Ava Rose Olson and her ideas of how to keep schools safe. And she is a veteran at the age of 7. And now an epilogue, which I wrote again. It's not a repeat, though. This is brand new this morning. A friend insists that history is dead, that it is meaningless and irrelevant in this bizarre age of Trump, who disregards every lesson of history, if he is even aware of any, while he aggressively dismantles democracy and imposes the evils of white male supremacy and homemade fascism. Yet how else might we find precedents for defeating Trump's iniquitous impulses, except through research of similar necrological demons? Caligula and Nero come closest to mind in their megalomaniacal comparability. Research is essentially the study of history. Today's date might provide a few examples of historical evil, such as May 24, 1943, when the Nazi angel of death, Dr. Josef Mengele, arrived at Auschwitz to begin his horrible experiments on thousands of Jewish prisoners, in particular women and children. Also today, in 1964, when Republican presidential candidate Barry Goldwater, not an evil person, proposed in an interview the onerous use of nuclear bombs on North Vietnam to defoliate jungles, obliterate its rice agriculture, and destroy its infrastructure, with apparently no mention of human casualties that would most likely surmount Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined or even tripled. And on a much smaller scale, the car bombing today in 1990 that blew apart the car but did not kill two members of the radical environmental group Earth First, one of whom was the famous activist for preserving California redwoods, Judy Berry. She and fellow passenger Daryl Cherney accused the FBI and the Oakland Police Department of the bombing, which the FBI counter-accused them of. Judy Berry died in 1997 at the age of 47. Perhaps a lasting memorial would be naming the redwood forest she tried so hard to save after her. This is Michael McCusker. Happy start of the annual silly season, otherwise known as Memorial Day weekend. I personally think this year's commemoration ought to be for the dead school children, whose KIA list apparently exceeds the deaths so far this year of American military deaths in various combats all over the world. Whose names do any of us know? And also, by the way, Bob Dylan is 77 today. I end with a poem by Crystal McCubbin, who wrote it many years ago for a newspaper I published, the North Coast Times Eagle. It speaks directly to our bodies, ourselves, and she is a teacher. I am fat, by Crystal McCubbin. Yes, I am fat, not pleasingly plump, not overweight, not chubby, fat. I can say the word. That does not give you the right to abuse me. That does not give you the right to let your children abuse me. The size of my body does not make me a better, greater, or weaker, worse person. Fat is not beautiful. Fat is more often than not protection. It is painful protection. Fat is feeling your colors are too bright. Fat is a mud wash on a Monet painting. Fat is a friend you wish you had, your lover on a gale-blown night, the risk you are afraid to embrace. My fat is me. It is mine to deal with. It is my joys, my fears, my untold secret. It is my protection. It is mine to painfully probe. You are doing me a favor by listening, loving me. Being fat is a long journey through steep valleys filled with crystal, sharp, rocky crags. My fat is mine to fight, mine to struggle with, mine to explore, mine to bleed for, not yours. And that was by Crystal McCubbin. I am fat. And this, again, has been Michael McCusker. Happy Memorial Day.